town, and before it, he interviewed for like 3 years to get this promotion, and he actually interviewed for a position in Alpine. And when he came home, he knew he was the most qualified, but he wasn't going to get it. And God gave him a dream that the young guy, brand new, out of Alpine, was going to get it, and that he was going to wait. And the next day, he got the email. The guy from Alpine got it. 2 days later, Sam gets the email, and then the call that he actually got the promotion in El Paso. And it was, God had given me a dream, he had given Sam a dream, and it was all working like it was supposed to. It had been a long wait, and so our physical reminder right now is that he still lives in El Paso, and we are still here, but that he's kind of shaping the same things. I mean, we've heard, you know, we're 900 miles away, and we've heard the same sermons in threes at the same time, and we call each other super excited, and we're telling each other the same thing. And so we're really praying that that's coming to an end. But the way that he spiritually formed all of that, even though we're thinking, is there ever an end?
Mm-hmm.
We're promised there's an end because he was at the beginning.
That's cool. That's good. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Oh, wow.
But each time I know that, I remember that God was there.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very physical reminder. So, hey, guys, come on up. Oh, there's seats right on the front row just for you guys. Tell you what, there is also an extra chair here. If you want to set that one on the back row, maybe. Okay, so we're discussing the question, do you have any physical reminders of your spiritual journey? So that's a very physical reminder. Anything else? Anybody else? Maybe a Bible special to you, a journal, anything like that? Heirloom, something from your family? Well, tell you what, just let that question sit with you today. Because that's something we're going to see in Abram's walk today as we start talking about Abram and get into kind of his journey and what that looks like. And we're going to see two sides to Abram today because Abram's got two sides, like we all do. Those times when we see things that we should do and we see things that we shouldn't do, which is kind of where we all are, right? And Abram's a really good example of that. So, we are in Genesis chapter 12. So, if you guys will open up to Genesis chapter 12 this morning. For you guys that are visiting with us, or this is your first Sunday, we have been in Genesis for a really long time. That started about a year and a half ago, I think, is when we started Genesis, and we are now in chapter 12. But it's actually going to pick up the pace a little bit, I think, And I think today will be a good example of that because we're going to get all the way to the end of chapter 12 today. This, I kind of labeled it, Abram builds an altar and goes to Egypt. So just kind of a quick reminder of where Abram's coming from. Abram started down here in Ur. He had this call out of that with his family. He moves up to Haran. And kind of moving up the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. This is modern-day Iraq. Moving over into what would be considered Syria, Lebanon, and down into modern-day Israel. And the places we're going to be talking about today are Shechem and then Egypt. And I just kind of wanted to make sure you guys kind of understand the locale that we're looking at. By the way, quick shout-out to Babylon, which we discussed back in chapter 11. Does anybody know what today is? Today is Pentecost. What's the connection with Pentecost and Babylon?
Jesus.
this is the homework part. This is just to find out what I've have I taught anything that's helped, or do we? Okay. Yes. The day of Pentecost is a reversal of Babylon, right? At Babylon, the Tower of Babel, we had the nations scattered. Their tongues were confused and they were spread out. At Pentecost, we see the absolute opposite of that. And in the list of all the nations that are mentioned, all the languages mentioned in Pentecost, we see that they could all understand one another. With the falling of the Holy Spirit. So this is a really important day in the life of the church. Some would call this the birthday of the church in many ways. And so that's kind of cool. So let's do this. So last week, we're just going to roll through the first part of this, just kind of a quick reminder. Starting in verse 12, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I'll show you, and I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great. So you'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I'll curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So we talked about this before, this idea of being told to leave, to go to something else. But notice all the promises that are made. He tells Abram he's going to make you a great nation. He's going to make your name great, which is the opposite of what they did at the Tower of Babel. Because remember, at Babel, they wanted to make a name for themselves. And this is Yahweh saying, I'm going to make your name great. And then this idea of blessing. The whole purpose of blessing here, it says, I'm going to bless you so that you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you and dishonor those that dishonor you, I'll curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, what a weird promise that is. Like, I'm sure it was really hard for Abram to even understand what that could possibly mean, especially in light of the fact that he didn't have an heir at that point that was from him. And in fact, he probably thought his heir was going to be a nephew. So Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions they had gathered, and the people that had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. We also talked last time about this idea of Abram being like on his own, just him and Sarah, and that was kind of it. No, he was probably a traveling warlord. He had a clan that was with him. Do we have any more chairs? Oh, there's two. You guys don't get to sit together this morning. So, tell you what, can we see if there's any chairs next door? There's one more right there? Okay. And I don't know if there's any next door or not. So, but we talked about this idea that that when Abram traveled, he traveled with a large entourage. And that, by the way, this entourage gets larger as he travels. And that's going to be even more obvious when we see some of his interaction with the locals. Because a lot of the locals feel very threatened when Abram rolls in. And he's meeting with different chieftains and local lords from all these other different areas. So this gets us to our new part. We're in Genesis chapter 12. Let's do this. Let's see if I can get some help this morning. Would anybody like to read 6 through 9? Who'd like to read 6 through 9 for me? You got it? And if somebody could read 10 through, let's say, 13? 10 through 13? Anybody?
Okay.
Got it? Okay. And then we'll close out 14 through 20. Who wants to read 14 through 20 for us? All right. You got it. All right. So we're going to read through the end of chapter 12.
Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built there an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. Abram journeyed on and still going towards the Negev.
Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for famine was severe in the land. It came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to his wife Sarai, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they'll let you live. please say that you're my sister so that it may go well for me because of you, and that I may live on the account of you.
Next.
When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarah. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? He said. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had.
Okay. All right. So let's start with observations. So what are some things that jump out at you? We've got themes we're looking for. We're looking for motifs. We're looking for these images that we've seen repeatedly. What do you see? What's that? Okay. Consequence of fear. What else? Any literary patterns? Okay, we got another altar built. Just one? What's that? Oh, does that sound interesting? Plagues in Egypt. Should sound familiar. We hadn't even gotten to that part of the story yet, but you should know, right? What else?
Interesting that he asked Sarah to lie, and yet he gets blessed through that.
That's kind of strange, right? Which is why we always have to be careful, the lessons we pull from the text, right? What else? How about the language? Okay. Do we see that language of he saw? Remember that from Genesis 1, right? See, what did Abram see? He saw about his wife, right? And then the Egyptians saw, right? Anything else? So, a couple of things I want you guys to look at. First off, I don't have my big map from the classroom. I'd be all over my map today. But I think it's important for us at this point to start paying real close attention to these locations, because these locations exist. You can go to these places today, which is kind of wild. I actually texted Chris today, said, hey, do you have any pictures of, and I listed a couple places. He was like, that's in Hebron. I think that's in the West Bank. I don't think we're ever allowed to go there. But we actually went very close to some of these places. So if you've got Israel, remember Israel, not very big, right? He comes down. This is the Sea of Galilee. This is Galilee right here, Capernaum up on the north coast here of the Sea of Galilee. Remember, Sea of Galilee, it's about the size of Lake Palestine, okay? To kind of give you some semblance of size there, except that doesn't have all the fingers going out of it like Lake Palestine does. It's just one big lake. So you've got the Sea of Galilee here coming down around this area. The area that it's mentioning here is Shechem, okay? Specifically, it's also going to mention not only Shechem, but down here, Bethel and Ai, which is just north of Jerusalem, okay? Which in Genesis is referred to as Salem, okay? And we'll talk about that a little bit later on, because there's going to be some interaction with Salem. Then you get further, as you get further and further to the south, what you end up running into is you end up running into desert, which is the reference to the Negev. You get down here, you get right around the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea. That area around there is pretty desolate and rocky. It's pretty rough conditions here. But up in here, hilly, nice. Jordan River connects the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea there. But the area that it's referencing is Shechem. And Shechem is interesting for a couple of reasons. So let's look real specifically at this reference to a tree, Nobody got the tree. Oh, I'm so disappointed. I told Bo, I was like, we're going to talk about trees. And she was like, good grief. And I was like, the Oaks of Moreh. Now, what's interesting about this is why would it mention that? It mentions that because, as we've said before, trees were significant, not just to the Genesis narrative, but all in the Jewish narrative, the narrative with Yahweh, but it's also significant for all the other cultures, all the other pagan cultures, and all the other pagan worship rituals. That is why they were constantly, and we see this throughout the rest of history, anytime Christianity came up in any kind of confrontation with different cultures, oftentimes they had sacred trees because that was seen as a place where the gods reside and speak to people and things like that. So here at Moreh, so what does Moreh mean? Guys, do we have any more chairs? No, I'm sorry. That's okay. Are there any next door? Okay. So Moreh means to pitch, to throw, to launch, but it also means to teach, okay? And in some instances, it actually means to rain, as in like the early rains, the rains that kind of soften up the ground, which is kind of an interesting thing there. So this idea of the Oaks of Moreh is, some believe, pretty much a reference to this idea of it's a place of teaching, or it's a place where oracles happen. It's a place where you go up to talk to the gods. By the way, it would have been on a hill. Oftentimes you would have sacred groves where you'd have up on these hilltops. And by the way, if we're talking about Israel, remember doing geography again, not a lot of trees, okay? So trees, really significant. I think I remember telling you guys when we went, I was shocked. Here in Texas, when it's hot and humid, getting out of the sun is helpful, but sitting under a tree is only moderately helpful because it's still extremely humid, right, and hot. I was shocked how there, where it's extremely arid, when you got under a tree, like the temperature, boom, I mean, it plummets when you're underneath the tree because the air is so dry. And so it really is an oasis to be able to sit in the shade of a tree. So in this part of the world where you have these shady groves of trees, especially these large trees, when most of the trees are kind of scrubby and small, that would be seen as kind of a sacred place, especially if it was on a high place, right? Because that's where you talk to the gods. So it's insinuating here that this was probably maybe the location of where the Canaanites also had worship practices. Because you'll notice it says in here, whenever Abram comes into the land, back in verse 6, it says to the Oak of Moreh, now the Canaanite was then in the land. So it's saying the Canaanites were there. There were people there, okay? But notice what Abram does. He comes in. He doesn't worship in the way of the Canaanites. What does he do? He builds his own altar. Now, notice he built an altar. What does it not say that he did? Because I'm thinking an altar. What's an altar for? To put things on, right? Doesn't mention that. It does not talk about any kind of sacrifice that was made. He just talks about building an altar, which is kind of fascinating. Now, this is an area where we're going to hear this passage again. This is actually in Deuteronomy, and it says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, you shall set all the blessings on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not beyond the Jordan, west of the road, towards the going down of the sun, in the land of the Canaanites who live in Arabah, opposite Gilgal beside the Oak of Moreh, and that's actually plural, so it like literally means the oak grove of Moreh. This is the passage in which Joshua brings the Israelites in. For you guys that have been with us for a really long time, back when we did our study of Deuteronomy, this is where the blessing and the curse was put before Israel, and they were given the options. And the area that they are in is Shechem, where you can go today. You can literally go to Shechem, and on one side of Shechem is Mount Gerizim, and on the other side is Mount Ebal. And the thing is, what's interesting about the two is this was considered a little bit more barren and desolate up on top as opposed to Gerizim, which would have been a little bit more fruitful up on top. And so this is where Abram, for the first time, acknowledges what God has done in some sort of physical way. So far, God's spoken to Abram. God has followed. But in this instance, God actually not only made the promise, because remember, we've also gotten a promise already, right? I'm going to make you a blessing. I'm going to make your a name great and create a great nation, all this. This particular instance, he doesn't say that again. He just basically tells him, this is the land I'm giving you. So it's a very different kind of promise this time. He says, this is the land I'm going to give you and your descendants. And if you look at the map of Israel, it's it's right smack dab in the middle of Israel. So he's come down in. He's here between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, which will, and by the way, all of these places will figure very prominently in the rest of the Old Testament. In fact, we're going to hear even more about this later on, even in the New Testament, because there's indications that Shechem is also going to be very near where Jesus meets the woman at the well, the Samaritan, because this is an area that's around Samaria. Okay, a couple of other interesting things of note you want to know about where they are. First off, so after they go down and he meets at Shechem, he moves further south to a place called Bethel. Okay, Bethel, or Bethel, literally means house of God. And Bethel is opposite of another place that's mentioned, which is Ai, which literally means a ruin or a heap. So there is this idea, once again, of contrast. This idea of house of God, this idea of ruin, okay, this knot, right? So you're constantly being presented with these contrasts, which is very going to be very similar to what we see with Mount Gerizim and Ebal also, which was a little bit further to the north. So, we already said this. Abraham built two altars, and neither one of them does it mention a sacrifice. Now, that's significant because he's eventually going to make a sacrifice, but it's what God tells him to sacrifice. He doesn't just get to sacrifice kind of whatever he wants. He gets very specific instructions with the kind of sacrifice that he makes. So, basically, what Abram did is he built monuments. Now, I've been in D.C. for the last week. I've had monuments up to here, right? But let me ask you guys, what's the purpose of a monument? What do monuments do? They remind. So, why do this? Why create these physical markers, physical spaces to do this? Sure. Tell you what, great example. So I can tell my kids all year long about, for example, Gettysburg. It's one of the places I got to go this last week with our seniors. I can tell them about Devil's Den. And I can tell them about Chamberlain at Little Round Top. I can talk about Pickett's Charge. I can do all those kinds of things. But it is a very different thing to walk onto the battlefield and see monuments placed there by men who were there that says, this is what happened here. That's a very different experience. You don't respond the same way. There's something to the telling. The telling is important. We need to do the telling. But sometimes you need a physical reminder, a physical space. And sometimes I think we create monuments for things we probably don't need to create monuments for. Monuments to man, that kind of thing. It's one of the things I really wanted our kids to think about and to contrast. What are the kinds of things that they found good about monuments, and what are some things that are maybe a little bit more troubling? And some of the monuments are that way. Some of the monuments really make you thankful. They give you gratitude for sacrifice and things that people had done. The Lincoln Memorial is a great example of that. The Lincoln Memorial just creates this kind of feeling of reverence and thankfulness for coming through that period in our history and kind of what we have. And then there's others that are just, I don't know what to think about them sometimes. You know, I'm not sure what I think about those particular monuments. One of the more moving monuments we went to was, the wall. If you've ever been to the Vietnam War Memorial, that's incredibly moving, especially for people that were in Vietnam. They come from all over. In fact, we had one of the grandparents of our group met us there. He did 3 tours in Vietnam, and he's got names of comrades on the wall. And our kids getting to see that man interact with that wall in that way, they're never going to forget that, you know. We need physical reminders. There's a reason why we see throughout the Old Testament these physical reminders of places and things like that. So, ask you guys again. Can you think of physical reminders of places in your spiritual journey that jump out at you? Maybe it's a place. I think for me, I'll give you all my place. My place is Piney Woods Baptist Encampment, because it's a place where I encountered God and people in a way that's unique that I never had at another time in my life, and it literally redirected the trajectory of my life. And when I go there, that's sacred space to me. I have arguments with Chris Legg all the time over whether space is sacred or not. He says it's the people that make them sacred. I say, yes, and not just the people. But that's me. Sacred just means it's set aside for something. It's set aside for God, right? Set aside for God. So be thinking about that. I'm going to close with that question again later on, okay? Okay, once again, the promises are different in this instance too, right? The first promise we got back, if we go all the way back to the beginning of chapter 12, it's, I'm going to make you into a nation, I'll bless you, I'll make your name great. In this instance, he's basically saying, look, this is where you're going to live, okay? And so he puts these markers down. This is a reminder, okay? Now, here's what's also kind of fascinating about Shechem and that region. They have recently discovered the altar of Joshua there on the mountain beside Shechem. And they've been excavating it, and they're fairly certain they think that's what that is. So, once again, these are real places. And by the way, why would they have built it? It was to remind people. It was true. We need physical reminders. We don't need just something in our head. It might be a thing. It might be an object. It might be, like I say, a journal, a special Bible. It might be a cross. It might be whatever it is. We need those physical reminders sometime. Okay, so let's keep going. So now part two. Okay, so now we're like, Abram, he's so cool. Doing the things that he's supposed to do to remember God's promises, that kind of thing. And then this happens. So there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe, and he was about to enter Egypt, and he said to Sarai, his wife, I know you're a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say this is his wife, then they'll kill me, but they'll not let, and they'll let you live. So say you're my sister, that it'll go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. So when Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful, and when the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. So his entourage grows. Abram continues to get blessed, despite the fact that Abram is not behaving well, right? Once again, that language that goes all the way back to chapter 3 of Genesis, to see and to take, right? I'm going to see and I'm going to take. It's that same exact verbiage there. One of those things that's kind of lost on us when we think about the literary context, but it's the exact same language that Eve said when she saw the fruit. We're going to see that language continue all the way throughout, to see and to take. And by the way, might Abram have had cause to be fearful? Okay. Tell you what, we'll back up. Does anything seem odd about this story? Aside from the fact of what he did? Is there anything else that seems odd about this story? Abram's 75, y'all. Okay. I was just wondering. Okay. So, Sarah would have been 65. If we just kind of read the text, kind of a plain reading of the text. So, what does that mean? She's older. But you can be beautiful at 65. I'm not saying that, but a lot of people reading this text struggle with that. They're like, what's this? It's not like she's like, you know, some teen princess or something like that. That's not what we have going on here. There are all sorts of different commentaries that kind of look at this kind of from different directions. And one of them is this idea that she was a princess of stature, and that could have had something to do with it, like just the fact that she was from this wealthy clan or tribe, and so it was actually would have been her reputation that actually kind of went before her in that way, and that's why Pharaoh wanted to bring her into his household, that kind of thing. Or, I don't know, maybe she was pretty 65, you know. It's possible, you know. What's that? I know, right? Hey, I'm about to turn. Hey, I'm about to turn. Can I make a confession to you guys? So every once in a while, I'll get a friend request on Facebook, and I'll see it and I'll go, "Who is that? Who's that old dude? Oh crud, that's a classmate. I'm that old dude." It's like, so yeah, that happens all the time now. So let's keep going through here. Okay, other kind of interesting part of this is that he gets blessed anyway. He gets blessed anyway. Why? What do you think's going on there?
Why are we saying it's a blessing?
With,
I mean, he sold his wife.
He did.
And then he gets his wife back, but she's now not necessarily just his wife. She's not a blessing. So he has to live with things that he thought he wanted, but he also has to live with his wife now.
Might there be a different understanding between the two of them at this point? Possibly. The question would become, was she okay with this deal? And maybe she was. I mean, don't put it past Sarah to be a little bit of conniving here. I mean, we're about to... Nobody will finish the story unscathed, right? That's hard to say. He got more stuff. He got more material blessing.
And I guess, what does God think about blessing? What is a real blessing? Is a blessing a house? Or is it the blessing of marriage? God kind of says, leave everything.
Sure. Well, I think you could look at it both ways. I mean, flourishing is flourishing, and to be blessed with material wealth can be both a blessing and a curse, depending on how it's stewarded, right? What's that? True.
I think he would have anyway. God had already told him that he was going to. I guess my question I would have is, was he supposed to go to Egypt?
That's another really good question. Was he supposed to go at all? Like, once again, taking matters into your own hands, right? Not saying that it was necessarily bad, but we just don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't say.
Yeah, yeah. But he goes, he connives. Who really gets punished in this? Pharaoh. By the way, Pharaoh's going to get punished again and again, right? This won't be the last time that the Egyptians don't come out of this well. There's all these overlapping things that are going on here. They go in, they take matters into their own hands, they try to fix it. But here's the fascinating thing about this. None of this changes the faithfulness of Yahweh's promise. Yahweh said he was going to do what he's going to do. And it doesn't, at this point, doesn't really matter kind of what Abram or Sarah, the conniving that they're up to, is going to make any difference. Yahweh's going to do what Yahweh's going to do. It's always tough when you're talking sometimes with folks, sometimes even within Christianity, but certainly without, when people don't have a kind of a good understanding of what the Bible actually is, because they'll see something in Scripture and think that it's all prescriptive, and it's not. A lot of the Bible is just descriptive. It's like, no, this is what happened. This is not what's supposed to happen. In fact, it was fascinating when we left the Bible Museum with the kids. They were talking about all sorts of things they saw in there, and one of the girls said, "I don't understand why they allowed having all the multiple wives and all that kind of thing." And it's like, I don't understand that. And pointed out, it's like, well, here's the thing: find a situation where that worked out well. Like it never worked out well. You starting with the first guy back over in Genesis, remember the guy that took all the wives and, you know, look how awesome I am. I murder everybody and I take women from everyone. I mean, it was like, because that was obviously not good. But even the heroes, like Abram, every time he does something that's not with Sarah, it doesn't work out. Like, there's consequences. And here's the other thing. I like the fact that there's consequences for not just you, right? The sin spills over. There's other people that get to suffer the consequences. You know, Egypt, people that, I mean, you could argue were at least in some sense, like, not morally responsible, were punished as a result of this. Families that were punished because of this. Because Yahweh's going to do what Yahweh's going to do. And if he's got to send plagues to make it happen, he'll send plagues or whales or whatever, you know, to make it happen. And that's what happens in this instance. We're going to see, I love the Rich Mullen songs, Jacob and Two Women. We'll come back later and I'm sure I'll play that at some point for you guys when we get to Jacob. But that very, very sad story of all of the wives and how one was loved, but the others were not. And they're very sad stories. So the Bible is full of descriptions of folks making really poor choices and suffering the consequences of that. And this is just one of those examples. It's a really good example.
John, I think you also see his mercy and grace there. So many times when I sin, there are times where I experience the consequences immediately, and I'm brought back. But there are other times it's more like what this is, where I'm rescued from my sin without necessarily experiencing all of the consequences that that I should be exposed to or would be just by him to do. Yet he brings me back and he teaches me and we move forward. But and this is kind of see that with Abram.
Sure.
Here, but they're kind of rescued in sorts and don't experience all of the consequences they could have.
Let me ask you guys this. What would be the wrong lesson to take from this? I got away with it, right? That, by the way, there's a lot of commentary that question whether or not Abram was actually repentant after this. Because it doesn't say. He never says he's sorry. I mean, by the way, this is going to kind of happen again later on. So, however, there will be some instances where Abram is called to account. And he's going to have to make very hard choices about the promises that were made to him and whether he's going to believe them or not. So, any other observations? Anything else you guys see?
I think it's important to recognize that they were coming probably so that they wouldn't starve, right? Mm-hmm. It was a famine. They were going to Egypt to try and get some food so they would live. So that is another piece when you feel like your back's against.
Oh, no, no.
The realities were harsh.
Yeah, when things get squeezed, we get morally compromised sometimes. for sure. And that may be what was going on there. You stole my thunder. Oh my goodness. You should be teaching. Yeah, we'd say for SUVs, right? For a new F-150, maybe not a donkey. Yeah, that's very true. It's one of the things that we're going to see. This interaction with Egypt. By the way, let's go back to our gods of the nations kind of discussion just briefly. Okay. Why did Yahweh? What's the purpose that Yahweh picked Abram? Why? You guys remember? Like, what? When we go back to Babel, what was happening? Why did Yahweh want Abram? To make a nation for his own. These are mine. You other gods, y'all have all these others. The Egyptians, they've got plenty, right? And by the way, we're going to see that fighting of gods. That's going to happen when they get to Exodus. All the other people groups had their own Elohims, right? But Yahweh, Abram belongs to him. And so, honestly, what Yahweh was doing with Sarah, sending the plagues on Egypt, was keeping the line separate for the plan that he had. And by the way, we'll do it again with Hagar. I mean, we're going to see this over and over where Yahweh's plan all along was to create a people for himself that was going to be a blessing to the whole world, right? Because it's through that that we'll get Messiah. It's through that that we'll get the Son of Man, where we all get adopted and we all get made part of the kingdom of God, that Yahweh calls all of us into being his own people. When all authority comes back on Jesus, when he takes all authority into himself, away from all the other Elohim. So in that framework also, make sure that you're seeing this, that in every one of these instances, it wouldn't surprise me if there were Elohims conniving to try to circumvent that, right? Because you've got all these other deities in rebellion against Yahweh, and aren't they going to try to do everything they can to make sure that Yahweh doesn't have a portion like his own. And by the way, that is the only explanation I can possibly have for understanding anti-Semitism. For you guys that have been watching anything going on in the news the last week. It's always fascinating when I teach world history and we would come to the 20th century and I'm teaching the concept of genocide and genocide isn't something that happened only with the Jews, but it's something that happened repeatedly with the Jews throughout history. And it's always funny because the students are like, I don't understand. Like, why them? Like that just doesn't make any sense. And I say, well, you don't think that makes sense. What makes even less sense is this is a people group that should have been wiped out a long time ago. and yet they survive. Not don't just survive, thrive, right? And now they literally have a country back, okay? By the way, I think we have to be careful. Are they perfect? Nope. Were they perfect in this description? Nope, right? So we have to be careful in saying whatever, you know, green lights to do whatever they want to do, but anti-Semitism, in my mind, only makes sense within the spiritual framework of that divine council concept where the other gods do not like Yahweh's kids. And they will do whatever they can to continue to try to wipe them out. It's the only way I can understand something like the Holocaust. And some of the weird hatred that we have today. You know, we got enough hatred going around for everybody, but that narrow focus there is just it's been very hard for me to understand. Apart from this way of understanding it. So, all right. Well, guys, I'm going to get us out a little early today. So let me pray for you guys. And we will pick up here next week. Look at that. Look at us. We got all the way through a chapter. We're gonna move on to chapter 13 next week. I promise. And hopefully we'll go over there and there will be more air conditioning. So, Father in heaven, thank you for Abram's reminders to us that we need reminders. Father, help us to look for those monuments. Maybe there's some monuments we need to set aside for ourselves to remind us to pray, to remind us that we have limits, to remind us that we're not in control, that we're not in charge, to remind us that we are yours, and so whatever the world has to offer and whatever the other Elohims have to offer doesn't matter. Because we belong to you. So, Father, help us to be faithful to you. Help us to be faithful to you, Jesus, in our interactions with one another, in our interactions with the world, in our interaction with our stuff, in our interaction with our plans, and our hopes, our dreams, our regrets. Father, all of those things belong to you because we belong to you. So, Father, give us the courage to hand those over this week. I pray that everybody in this room can think back to those physical reminders where you were present, where you were real, where your promises were fulfilled in our lives. And I pray this in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. All right. Y'all have a great week. I think this morning is Senior Sunday, so it's not Senior Citizen Sunday. It's Senior Sunday, so enjoy. Should be cool this morning.
All the way through Genesis on our drive out to Arizona.